From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be, across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Next hour, how men and women cope differently with stress, with best-selling author Dr. John Gray. John was behind the secret door about last week or so, and we're going to be bringing him on. Well, the Democratic contest in Indiana, too close to call so far, as late returns erased what had been a commanding lead for Senator Hillary Clinton. As polls closed in Indiana, Clinton had a double-digit lead over Senator Barack Obama, but the end of the evening, Clinton's lead had shrunk to a couple percent. This one's very close. The focus of the contest there shifted to Lake County, home to 8% of Indiana's population. We'll just have to sit back and see what happens there while we're on the air. Meanwhile, Obama has claimed victory in North Carolina. On the line with us now is onlinecolumnist.com, Dr. John Curtis, to shed some light on this. Still a close race, John.
George, it was a close race, but I believe that with the substantial, blowout in North Carolina, Barack Obama, I believe, is winning by over 15%, or with 99% of the precincts reported, and with the victory, lack of a victory substantial margin of victory in Indiana by Hillary. She was slated to win by 5 to 10%, and I think it was John Dogby who turns out to be the genius in this situation tonight, because Dogby's the one that predicted that in his polling that Obama was up by 2%. Now that's turning out to be prophetic, because that even though it's been called by CBS Indiana area, which is primarily African American, has yet to post the results. I think there's 92% that are voted, and with only a 2% margin. But the bottom line on all of this is that Hillary Clinton has not bounced, has shown no bounce whatsoever from Pennsylvania, and she needed a very substantial victory to keep her campaign going in Indiana. So I think it's safe to, I'm going to hazard a little bit of a guess here on the air, is that I think that Indiana has put Barack Obama over the top as far as this campaign. I think the pressure is going to be enormous tomorrow on Hillary to find a way out of this.
John Curtis, does either one of them have enough delegates? I mean, these two major primaries, the last of the major primaries, I mean, nobody's really wrapped it up yet, though.
No, I mean, Barack is 200, I believe he's 200 delegates away. I think this takes him at 2,025 or something tonight. But there are the superdelegates where the argument is being made, and these are these party officials who have voting privileges, are now being influenced by the outcome of Indiana. And I think last week, the Ipsos poll, that showed Hillary decisively beating John McCain, where Obama was virtually running even with him, made a very strong case last week for why Hillary should be wrapping up this campaign, and the momentum was clearly in her direction. But new polling this week showed that, in fact, it was both Obama and Hillary beating McCain in a general election, if it were held, this week, by 11 and 12%. So without the argument that the Clinton campaign can make to the superdelegates that she is a more competitive candidate in the fall with McCain, I think the fact that Obama has the lead in delegates will not surrender this delegate lead by the time the primaries end on June 3rd and can no longer say that she's the more competitive candidate. I think this is the tipping point in this campaign, and I think we're going to see a movement, a very substantial movement of superdelegates toward Obama, and I think it's going to put pressure on Hillary to step out.
All right, John Curtis. John Curtis, onlinecolumnist.com. Thanks for your perspective. And some other stories, foreign aid workers in the former Burma have concluded that as many as 50,000 people died in Saturday's cyclone, and that 2 to 3 million are homeless in a disaster on a scale almost comparable with the 2004 Indian Ocean tsunami. The official death count is just under half at around 22,500, but 41,000 people are missing. Authorities have arrested nearly 100 people and seized guns and drugs in a sting operation at San Diego State University in California. Among those arrested were 75 students, some of them working toward criminal justice or homeland security degrees. One criminal justice major was charged with possession of guns and cocaine. Although heart disease is the number one killer of women in this country, signs of a heart attack are often overlooked by women aged 55 and younger, according to the results of a new study. Researchers at Yale University's Medical Center in New Haven, Connecticut, studied 30 women, average age 48, who had suffered a heart attack. And while heart disease is more common in women after menopause, the study proved younger women are still very vulnerable. Kristen Wild, author of Miracle Stem Cell Heart Repair and Hidden Causes of Heart Attack and Stroke, our guest right now. Kristen, this latest study would tell you what?
It tell me, pardon me, that somebody's not doing their job. George, you've been talking about this. I mean, a few months ago, I think you were concerned that 35-year-old women were having heart attacks.
Yes.
Heart disease is preventable. The same genetic factors we know that are passed on to the man are passed on to the female patient. And if they're not looking for those, because there's a very interesting statistic in this particular study. When they interviewed these ladies, those survived, who survived the heart attack, 88% said that a sibling or a parent actually had heart disease in the family. That would give an indication that they're not looking intensively enough in the female patient for the same factors, the inherited factors, that have been coming through the family pipeline for generations. It's unfortunate. But a preventive cardiologist, when they ask a question of a patient on an application, for instance, what is the family history? And they delve very definitely into all the factors. They'll ask, did the father have a heart attack? Father had a heart attack at 65. What about your grandmother? Well, grandmother had one at 60. And so all of a sudden they're realizing that these hidden factors have to be detected in that female patient, because statistically she's not going to survive the first year of a heart attack nearly as well as a man. 44% do not make it through the first year compared to 26% of the men. Now, women have not been given the diagnostics that we guys have been getting. You and I have talked about that.
Yeah.
And as a result of that, physicians are missing opportunities. 33% of all heart attacks in female patients were missed by the physicians. So something has to be done. And what I suggest is that women must get more involved in their own health care. They need to come to speed on all of the things that they need to be tested for, because a young woman who walks into the doctor's office, who exercises and runs marathons and is involved in sports, has no weight problem, automatically, a person could easily say, this person doesn't have a real concern with heart disease. And yet we know it's genetic. We know it's passed on through the family line. So that kind of thinking has to change. And among the preventive cardiologists, they don't leave it there. They go a lot further in their diagnostics.
Well, all I know is in your preventative book, Hidden Causes of Heart Attack and Stroke, where you talk about inflammation, I think one of the major roles in complicating heart disease. I really invite everybody to just pick up a copy and get some information. And as you said, Christian, people have to start doing this themselves, too. They can't just wait for their doctor.
No, and they need to become prepared so that they can intelligently discuss it with the doctor and know what to ask for. You know, how many times have you and I talked about turmeric and fish oil?
Every time you're on.
Well, I'm doing the research for the second issue of the newsletter, and I was studying Alzheimer's, what's available, what looks like it has the most potential. Is it going to be pharmaceutical, biomedical drugs, or is it going to come from stem cells? And after all the studies that I looked at, the most promising, two studies that had the most effect on even Alzheimer's was turmeric and fish oil once again.
I love it. Well, you can get more information on Christian's website, myheartbook.com. Christian, thanks again, my friend.
Nice to talk to you. Thank you.
And that's an update where women under 55, even more susceptible to heart attacks if they don't take care of themselves. So please do. The man who helped build the 31 flavor craze at ice cream store Baskin-Robbins has died at the age of 90. Irvin Robbins died at his home in Rancho Mirage, California. He had been ill for some time. Robbins opened his first ice cream store in Glendale, California, back in December of 1945, following his discharge from the Army. Robbins offered 21 flavors at that store. His brother-in-law, the late Burton Baskin, opened his own ice cream store in the neighboring Pasadena area a year earlier, and the two eventually joined forces and made what you now know as Baskin-Robbins. A colossal black hole has been spotted exiting its home galaxy, kicked out after a huge cosmic merger took place. When two colliding galaxies finally merge, it is thought that the black holes at their cores may fuse together. We've got Richard C. Hoagland for just a brief update, just kind of a tease of things to come, with the head of the EnterpriseMission.com and best-selling author of Dark Mission, The Hidden History of NASA. Richard Hoagland, black holes we have to worry about now, Richard?
So you don't want me to do the breaking news, huh? We just had an update from MSNBC. Hillary has been apparently declared the winner of Indiana.
Very good. Thank you. Man, you're more than just a science advisor.
You got it. Well, right, when you're invited to speak at the Libertarian National Convention in Denver, which I have been in 2 weeks, you tend to try to hone your political chop.
Yes, you do. You're watching everything. Hey, this story, I just wanted to get you on to react to this thing. Is this any concern for us?
Only if it's headed in our direction.
Yes. Yeah, and I trust it's not.
And until tonight, I thought it would be the only thing that would end the primary on the Democratic side. This is really kind of cool because the model has been building over the years. It was found several years ago that all galaxies apparently have black holes at their cores. The Milky Way has one, which is 3 or 4 million solar masses. Andromeda, the beautiful spiral in Andromeda, has one about the same size. This one that's been kicked out by a galaxy merger, two huge galaxies rushing together under gravity, is over 100 million times the mass of the sun. So this was part of the narrative, as they say these days, the story. But until this observation, which was made by a team from the Max Planck Institute for Extraterrestrial Physics last week, we didn't really have observations that this, in fact, could occur. And now it's gone from theory to fact.
I love it. Richard C. Hoagland, we're going to get you back for a full program very shortly, Richard, because I know you've been working on some incredible things for us. EnterpriseMission.com. Just up, the other Roswell UFO crash on the Texas-Mexico border. This is an incredible story, and we've got it for you next on Coast to Coast AM. We are going to talk this hour about an incredible story with two incredible people that's called The Other Roswell, the UFO crash on the Texas-Mexico border. I've got for you two major guests. Noe Torres and Ruben Uriarte are active members of the UFO research community with many years of experience as investigators, authors, and lecturers. They have traveled extensively while conducting research for their books and have spoken at numerous conferences, including the Roswell Museum's annual UFO Festival, the UFO Crash Retrieval Conference in Las Vegas, and the Bay Area UFO Expo. We're going to talk about the UFO crash on the Texas-Mexico border and also the information. We've got some sound bites from Colonel Robert Willingham, a retired U.S. Air Force Reserve, and wait till you hear this. First of all, we'll go to Noe. Hello, Noe. Welcome to the program.
Yes, greetings to everyone from the South Texas border right here along the Rio Grande River.
Well, it's good to have you with us. And Ruben, hello to you, my friend.
Hey, how are you doing there, George? And greetings from the San Francisco Bay Area.
Always a pleasure to have you. This one, both of you jump in at any time. I won't necessarily address this to either one of you, but separately. But the other Roswell, the UFO crash on the Texas-Mexico border. Now, this is about a UFO crash near Del Rio in southwest Texas. Why don't you give us an overview on that?
Okay, Georgia. Basically, the Colonel Willingham at the time, he was flying as part of a group of F-86 fighter jets. They were escorting a group of B-47 bombers across west Texas. And it was a Cold War simulation designed to follow the route that bombers would take to reach Russia in the event of a nuclear war. And then he got a radio message, and they warned Willingham and the other fighter pilots that there was a fast-moving UFO that was approaching Texas from the northwestern United States. Suddenly, it came into their view, and it looked like an intensely bright light, like a bright star seen through a telescope. And it blazed across the sky, and it passed them, and everyone in all the planes saw it. But because of the location of Willingham's jet, he was the best. He was in the best position to see what happened after the object flew by. He estimated the object was traveling about 2,000 miles per hour, and then he saw that he made a sudden 90-degree turn without slowing down. As the UFO streaked toward the Texas-Mexico border, Willingham, received permission to break from the formation and pursue the object of his F-86 fighter. And he was following the object's vapor trails when it went down near Del Rio, Texas, where he saw it suddenly begin to wobble and it descended rapidly. Well, what happened there, George, he watched it, and it plunged across toward the Rio Grande River, plowing into the ground just south of Lantry, Texas, and digging out a 300-long furrow before finally coming to rest alongside of Sandy Hill. And he's heard a lot about UFOs, but here he was standing and flying right over one as it crashed there on the banks of the Rio Grande. Later, he got permission to fly back to Carswell Air Force Base, and he returned his fighter plane and picked up a small propeller-driven plane used for pilot training. And he actually, him and another friend of his named Jack Perkins, they flew the small plane back down on the UFO crash site, arriving several hours after the initial crash.
All right.
I'll turn it over to Noe. He could tell you more about the actual debris and the crash site itself.
Okay. All right. Because, Noe, did they finally get to the point where they went down on the ground here, or did they send in soldiers? What happened?
Well, the incredible incident that took place after the arrival of Willingham and Jack Perkins at the crash scene, they found, of course, Willingham had seen from his F-86 fighter jet earlier in the day, he had seen the debris field that was created by the crash of this UFO. It was a 300-yard-long trench in the ground where the UFO hit and then bounced and then scraped up the earth for about 300 yards before it came to rest. And the whole area was littered with metallic debris that was just, you know, very shiny in the sun. And so after Willingham took his jet back to base and returned in the small plane with Perkins, they actually landed right alongside the crash debris, got out of the plane and walked toward the crashed UFO. And it was then that they were confronted by a number of Mexican military personnel who had arrived at the scene prior to their arrival, and they had cordoned off the area, they had sealed off the area, they were armed, and they kept Willingham and Perkins away from the main area of the crash site. But they did get up close. They did manage to get up within 35 feet of the main section of the crash, and what they saw there was really incredible. And unbeknownst to them, their entire lives were about to change because of this encounter that they had.
We're going to talk about how those lives changed after the break. Did anybody see occupants?
Basically, in this particular incident, he didn't have enough time to really get close to the main part of the aircraft structure, mainly because the Mexican military were getting very nervous about having them around. And one of the things that they did tell him was that they were there waiting for someone from the United States Air Force to arrive. And, of course, he showed, you know, he was in his flight suit, but what he told us in our interviews was that there were very large chunks of metal, and basically the structure was broken into two main parts. One was the actual dome, which he really wanted to get closer to, but because he was being rushed out of the crash site, he had to get back to his plane because it was getting dark. And secondly, the most important thing what he did was he actually picked up a piece of the fragment, a piece of the metal.
We'll talk about that metal, too, when we come back. This is an incredible story again, the other Roswell. The picture on the cover of their book is absolutely riveting. It's a drawing, of course, but it highly depicts exactly what Colonel Robert Willingham saw as he was flying overhead. And we've got some sound bites with the colonel as well. We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Hey, May 17th, if you just go to the coasttocoastam.com website, you'll see that there's going to be a special event in the Los Angeles area. There's going to be a special tribute to a very preeminent researcher there. But this is called UFOs, Magic, and Mysticism in Hollywood. And I invite you all to just go to the website and come on by. It's going to be a great event Saturday night, May 17th. I'll be out there in Los Angeles. I do believe producer Tom will be there, and Whitley Strieber, Dr. Roger Lear, Jay Wiedner, Jordan Maxwell. Come on out. We'd love to see you. I'll be back in a moment with Noe Torres and Ruben Udiarte as we talk about the other Roswell on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie. We're talking about the other Roswell, a UFO crash on the Texas-Mexico border. We're going to play a couple sound bites of the Colonel Robert B. Willingham, who spotted this crash. Now, Ruben, you were talking about some material that Willingham picked up, very strange metal. What was it and where is it?
Well, what had happened was that when he was returning back to his plane, the small little little Cessna-type plane that he had there, he noticed there was a small piece of metal, and he immediately put that into his pocket. And then later, he got back in, and it was still hot, George. He had to wrap it up in a handkerchief. This is based on what he had shared with us. He put it in his coat. When he flew back, he later started to test the the metal because his father was a metallurgist back then. He worked for an oil company. And so he was very familiar with welding and that, and so he tried to test the metal, and he knew right off the bat that this was something completely different. Later, what he decided to do was to hook up with a metallurgical lab up in Virginia. It was a military testing lab, and he took it up there, and they had to evaluate it. And I think I'll turn this over to Noe there, because I know that Noe, if you could finish off with that part there.
Well, it's a fascinating story, because the one thing that Willingham has told us that convinces him this object did not have an earthly origin was that piece of metal that he found. That was really the clincher for him. You know, in addition to the fact that the aircraft, when he observed this strange aircraft moving across the sky, did not resemble anything at all that was man-made, but the object that he picked up, it had certain properties and characteristics that convinced him beyond a doubt was not of earthly manufacture. He was not able to burn it with a torch, high-intensity heat. He was not able to cut it or scratch it or mar it in any way. It would warm up a bit, but it would not get very hot. There was a honeycomb pattern to the inside of this piece of metal, which was about the size of a man's hand. He took it to the Marine Corps metallurgic lab in up in the East Coast, and he turned it over to them because he realized that he had reached a point where he didn't have the testing equipment that was needed to conduct further research into what exactly it might be composed of and so forth. So he took it in. He had a friend that he had met in the military who ran this lab, or who was part of this lab operation, took it up there and turned it over to them. A couple days later, he called back. He called this gentleman up there at the lab that he knew, and he was told that the lab had closed down overnight, that the person he had turned that strange, unearthly piece of metal over to no longer worked there, and nobody knew where his present whereabouts were. And later he received a phone call from an unidentified military person at that metallurgic lab, who told him, "Not only can we not tell you anything about the piece of metal you brought here to us, but we don't want you to ever mention it to anybody again."
Jeez. Okay, and what we've got here, a couple of sound bites. We're going to listen to the first one here of Colonel Robert B. Willingham as he talks about what he spotted. Here we go.
We spotted a bright light, and I mentioned it to the B-47 Pollard of our close communications equipment, and he seen it also. Well, it kind of looked like, like a star does, except it was closer. Uh-huh. Bright, real bright light. There was a little amber-looking color in it there once, or I thought it was.
Okay, and then the second clip here. Here we go.
It was coming, looked like straight toward us, and all at once it made a 90-degree turn and started losing altitude. And I mentioned that to the B-47 pilot, and he said, yeah, I seen that.
So they saw this. Now, this was in 1955, and to this day, we still don't have anything, at least that I know of, that makes a 90-degree turn, Ruben, do we?
Really, I mean, it's just like, certainly there's been a vast improvement of fighter these stealth planes and that, but to turn at 90 degrees at a 2,000 mile per hour flight, I mean, that's really very, very mysterious.
Now, in terms of Willingham, he's still alive?
Yes, he is, and we're very lucky to be able to interview him. He lives up in the near Wichita Falls, and we went down and visited him on several occasions, and we have hours of testimony, of hours of tapes that we've also conducted in our research. So he is one heck of a guy there, George. He's fought in World War II. He was with the 182nd Airborne. He was a fighter pilot. He flew 51 Mustangs in Korea. And now, and then, of course, he flew jets during the Cold War, during the 1950s era.
10 years later, in Kecksburg, Pennsylvania, there was an apparent crash also of a UFO. Willingham had some interest in that. Tell me about that.
Now, the interesting thing there, George, is that Willingham's entire life changed after his UFO encounter in 1955. He went on to become extremely interested in the whole topic of flying saucers, unidentified flying objects. He followed the whole area very closely for many years. Of course, the 1950s were a hot time for UFO sightings throughout the United States. Especially, we were seeing a lot of UFO sightings happen over military bases and secure military areas, which made the military, of course, extremely nervous. Willingham, as it turned out, actually became a part of the Air Force's Project Blue Book in the late 50s and early 60s, and he himself participated with great interest, of course, because of his own UFO experience. He participated in numerous UFO investigations in the early 60s. He took depositions from witnesses. He went out and investigated where these sightings had occurred. And he said that he has told us that of the hundreds of UFO sightings that he himself investigated, he could only about half of them could actually be discounted as something that was misidentified or that had an earthly origin. So in other words, he's telling us that of the many hundreds of cases that he worked as a Project Blue Book investigator, only about half could be explained through conventional explanations. So his interest in Kecksburg was just coming out of Project Blue Book. Of course, he still had vivid recall. He's 82 years old now, and he still has tremendous recall of the UFO encounter that he had and the time he spent in the military and with Project Blue Book. And so Kecksburg in 65, there was a rumor of a UFO that had crashed in a forest there. It was very near to where he was living at the time in Pennsylvania. So he went over there, and he was monitoring radio traffic when he heard military radio traffic transmissions when they were talking about this strange object that had crashed. So So he went out there, and although he wasn't an official part of the investigation, he made an effort to find out more about that because of his own long-standing interest in UFOs, which remains to this day.
You published this book, RoswellBooks.com, by the way, this year, 53 years after the event. What took so long?
It's a very interesting story in that when this story was actually known in the mid to late 60s, it was about 10 years after Willingham had his UFO encounter that he started talking about it. Now, he had been bullied and intimidated by several military intelligence types following the event. He was told, you know, that incident that you had down on the border, you're never to speak about that to anyone ever. And so he received several phone calls of this nature within 2 weeks after the incident happened. And he was really fearful, and he remains to this day somewhat, you know, intimidated and fearful by the amount of pressure that they put on him. But in the 60s, on the occasion of the Kecksburg, shortly after the Kecksburg UFO crash incident in 65, he was being interviewed by a newspaper reporter there in Pennsylvania, and they were talking about UFO sightings that had been made in the area by Civil Air Patrol pilots, and he just suddenly told the reporter, you know, I was once involved. I saw one of these objects crash down there near Del Rio, Texas, and that was the first public mention that he made of this case. So shortly after that happened, somebody from NICAP at that time, which was a civilian UFO investigator.
One of the first.
Somebody from NICAP saw the clipping of that newspaper from Pennsylvania and filed it. And it wasn't until 10 years later that a gentleman named Todd Zeckel, who was one of the early UFO investigators, well known to a lot of people in the field, followed up and tracked down Willingham in the late 70s and kind of really was the person that discovered Willingham and his story. And this was, you know, the first book about Roswell was published in 1980. Stanton Friedman did the research for the first Roswell book called The Roswell Incident. He did it in 78. That was when he finally connected with Jesse Marcel Sr., the base intelligence officer at Roswell Army Air Force Base during the 1947 crash of the UFO in Roswell, near Roswell. So actually, the Willingham UFO encounter and the Roswell case itself have always gone kind of hand in hand. And Willingham's case was really out in the public even before the first book about the Roswell case was known, which is, you know, these are part of the rationale behind calling this book The Other Roswell. These two cases very closely aligned together.
What is it about Colonel Willingham's story that makes both of you feel that it's real?
Well, partly, again, his background, him being a fighter pilot, his military experience. I mentioned he was involved in World War II and with the 182nd Airborne. And it was he was injured in Korea. He also served as a military provost in the city of Munich, Germany, at that time. In our constant interviews with him, and the time frame that he had spelled out, and all the other incidents that were occurring during the 50s. You know, he had mentioned that the 50s was a hotbed of UFO activity from the Washington D.C. overflights and. You know, one thing that was really striking to me, and I'll just mention this real quickly. And I know Frank who wrote the book Shoot 'Em Down. He had some interesting statistics. Korean War during 1950 through 53, there were 104 aircraft lost to enemy action, and during 1951 through 1956, there was 185 military aircraft lost during that time chasing UFOs, over 199 aviators that died, and these were well-seasoned fighter pilots. Well, talking to a man like Willingham, who has many, many hours of flying time, and also his experience, he's definitely one man that we really hold in high esteem. He's a hero to us, basically.
George, another thing that came into play here is we had some we had a great deal of assistance from Dr. Bruce McAbee, who is one of the leading, of course, UFO investigators in our country today. And he had he was very familiar with the Willingham story, although he had never personally interviewed him. When we were doing our book Mexico's Roswell, which by the way has just gone into a second edition, is available through our website as well. We were doing Mexico's Roswell a couple of years ago, actually about 3 years ago, and when we started hearing the story about, well, actually, you know, there was a UFO crash along the border, but it wasn't this one that you all are talking about in 1974. It was an earlier one, and it involved a gentleman named Willingham. So that was the beginning of how we got interested in this case. We connected with Dr. McAbee, and Dr. McAbee ended up pointing us in the right direction. We connected. We finally connected with Colonel Willingham through Dr. McAbee's efforts as well, and the whole story came out at that time. And one of the things that Dr. McAbee, who wrote the foreword for this for our book, says is that that Willingham's life story is so fascinating. You know, he served under General Patton in World War II. He decorated. Military veteran, very credible individual, Dr. McAbee points out in the foreword of the book, and his life would be tremendously fascinating even without this story about the crashed saucer. Willingham has never gained anything from the publicity. You know, there has never really been much publicity, and he has gained nothing from talking about this UFO case. It has actually done nothing but, in his opinion, hurt his career, because there's been several instances where apparently things have not gone right for him while he was in the military service and the reserves because of him talking about this case. So really, that's why we think it's a highly credible witness.
Dr. McAbee writes about your book, "I believe that the reader will find this book important support of the idea that alien flying craft have crashed on Earth and have been retrieved and covered up by the United States government." In summary, do you both believe that indeed we picked up a crashed alien ship? You first, Noe.
I believe that this is one of several, and Dr. McAbee also bears me out from examining the evidence, listening to our conversations with Willingham and so forth. This is one of several unidentified aircraft, not of earthly origin, that have been recovered over the years. There's been a few, and this is one of a handful.
And how about you, Ruben?
Well, I definitely believe that a crash had occurred. And one of the things that we've asked and what we're looking for is, because once this investigation starts, we're hoping to get additional witnesses. One are his fellow F-86 pilots that also flew out with him during out of Carswell, the pilots and the crew members of the B-47s, the family of the late Jack Perkins, who also flew with Willingham at the crash site, even the Mexican Army personnel and the other government officials who saw the crash UFO across the Rio Grande. And I just wanted to mention real quickly is that the Mexican researchers are now going to be approaching the Mexican government to release their files. And for the whole thing under the Disclosure Act. So hopefully we'll get more information as to what it was Mexico's role in terms of assisting the United States when it comes to crash retrievals along the Texas-Mexico border. So as Noe had indicated, we're finding out more and more about these crashes, and we want to definitely get them out to the American public.
Well, I'm proud of the work that both of you have done. The other, Roswell, where do you get it?
It's available on Amazon.com and most online booksellers, and also through our website, which is RoswellBooks.com.
Very good. Thank you, you two. Great story.
Hey, thank you very much, George, for inviting us, and hope to be back again.
A remarkable story, the other Roswell, this crash near the Texas-Mexico border. And what's so compelling about this is the eyewitness testimony of Colonel Robert B. Willingham. Man, that's something. I'll be back in a moment. If you've ever been under stress, you've got to listen to the program when I come right back.